This episode of Section D was first broadcast on Tuesday, the 19th of March, on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Lexus. Hello and a very warm welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Hugo MacDonald. Coming up over the next hour, we uncover the role graphic design is playing in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in Jerusalem.
I was brought up on a tradition in using design into conveying political messages. Like, this is not new for the Palestinian cause.
We head to Jakarta and dive into the fantasy world of toy designer Chipta Croft-Cosworth. And back in Berlin, we drop in on the studio of illustrator and animator Christoph Niemann to talk virtual petting zoos.
You have a big crocodile's head, and when you swipe over the teeth, they start moving and bending one way or another. And then you get this like chord, like this arpeggio chord. The sound design ended up almost like building the animals as instruments.
More on that shortly. Also in the show, we'll have a roundup from last week's ISH Biennial Bathroom Trade Fair in Frankfurt. We'll visit the Porto-based design studio R2, and we'll get a read on the second annual India Design Forum in Mumbai too. That's all to come over the next hour here on Section D on Monocle 24. We begin this week's Section D in Jerusalem. Provocative graphic design is not the first thing that springs to mind regarding the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians. Yet the last few months has seen a surge in the use of sharp design templates and data visualization by a new generation of Israelis and Palestinians attempting to articulate conflicting perspectives on the past, present, and future of their saturated conflict. In a polarised situation where viewpoints have been entrenched by years of bitter fighting, the simple language of clean graphic design is having success at changing how the debate is formed and understood, both at home and abroad, as Monocle's Joseph Dana found out in Jerusalem.
Tattered posters with keffiyeh-wearing fighters brandishing AK-47s are synonymous with Palestinian refugee camps in Jordan and Lebanon. These posters are the bedrock of Palestinian political design, dating back to the early 1960s. A new generation of Palestinian designers are now embracing this colorful, if sordid, tradition, but not simply to embolden their base. Rather, they are using design to articulate their political aspirations to the international community.
I was brought up on a tradition in using design into conveying political messages. Like, this is not new for the Palestinian cause. And I grew up seeing posters that were produced back in the 60s and the 70s from the early times of the Palestinian Revolution.
That's Hafez Omar. With a fine arts degree from Al-Najah University in Nablus, Omar has been quietly producing startling and engaging posters inspired by the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, as well as the events in Palestine. His images have spread across the world like dandelion seeds, given the explosion of social media platforms since the Arab revolutions of 2011. Despite the changes in technology, he believes that the content of his work has its roots in the decades-long tradition of design in Palestine.
Basically, what all the Palestinian design is trying to say, like the unity of the people, like these big slogans, these big addresses that the Palestinians have been talking about through design. What I did is just the shape. To renew the shape and to present it according to the technological development, the language have changed, the dissemination way have changed. You know, before you used to look at walls, real walls in the streets to see posters, but now you have the Facebook, you have the social media and the internet, which allows these kind of posters and designs to spread wider and to get to more people.
Omar's design captures the early, passionate days of Palestinian iconography with colorful imagery and popular appeal. Some of his posters appear almost dangerous, giving the viewer a window into the passion of a political movement through a potent mix of imagery and politics. But it's not just intriguing poster art that is transforming the graphic design world in Palestine. Founded by Ramzi Jabbar, a Palestinian engineer, Visualizing Palestine is a Ramallah-based design studio with offices in Amman. They use data visualization to articulate the Palestinian perspective on the conflict with Israel with unexpected graphic wit. Jabbar explains how the idea came into being.
It started as I was organizing for a conference called TEDx Ramallah, which is an independently organized TED event in Ramallah in 2011. As I was organizing for it, and I realized that there were huge amounts of statistics about what is happening in the West Bank and in Palestine and in Israel in general, and realized that there's a huge dichotomy between the mainstream media and what's happening on the ground and in terms of event and political reality. And I saw the power of storytelling. You know, TED, at the time, TED website had over 400 million views. So why don't we marry both together? And then started fomenting in my mind, how do you use design, storytelling for social issues and to expose social justice issues?
Visualizing Palestine draws upon years of research gathered by various international and Israeli human rights organizations. The information is then presented in unexpected ways, with deep colors and handsome fonts, giving the viewer a rare glimpse into life in Israel and Palestine. In one recent visualization, looking at the issue of road systems in the West Bank, a slice of asphalt hangs in the center of the page, as if in an architectural rendering program. Bits of data about the structural framework of Israel's control over the West Bank hang softly around the suspended slice of road. Otherwise bland information is shown in a profoundly new and enticing way. The international reaction to the Visualizing Palestine project has been overwhelming, presenting Ramzi Jabbar with a set of challenges for future growth.
We have two pillars. One is that we use factual data from reputable organizations that can be refutable, and we want to use the principle of equality and dignity. So these are the two things that nobody can refute with. And we want to become a source, a visual source, for the narrative, a factual narrative, a true narrative of what's happening on the ground, and for people to use our visuals to cross the divide between this information and positive change. How do you cross between? This is what we occupy ourselves. How do we do that? Do we use it? Our work is mainly online, except with a few things offline. Should we go offline? Should we, you know, this is the thing we keep thinking about. What are more powerful ways to connect or to tell the story?
It's not just Palestinians using design to articulate their positions on the conflict. Design studios in Tel Aviv have been working feverishly to push sharp design campaigns into the international discourse. Last year, outgoing Israeli Deputy Foreign Minister Danny Ayalon appeared in an animation which articulated Israel's claim to the West Bank. The video was shared millions of times due to its exuberant, colorful style. Ayalon walked around a drawing of the West Bank as small animations illuminated the conflict's history from Israel's perspective. For Ali Garib, the senior editor of Open Zion, an American news site covering Israel and Palestine, along with the Middle East, the video was a success because of its design, not its argument.
Where the design really came into Ayalon's video is the fact that he can so easily draw dichotomies between the two sides of the conflict, between the Jews and non-Jews, because when you're here on the ground, you know, there are some obvious differences, but then other ones are not so clear. But when you're using design to get your point across, you can make that very clear by simply inserting symbols or having one group look one way and another group look another way. And so I think that that's one way that the design really brings across his message clearly, is he's able to oversimplify it into these groups very easily. And so I think in that sense, his video was helped. You know, if you just used, say, photographs and done a photo slideshow, it's not always so clear being able to tell Israelis and Arabs apart, but with a graphic design, it's very easy to do that and show the numbers and bring his message across.
In the standoff over shaping the narrative of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, it is natural that the vocal language of design has become one of the most dynamic fronts for storytelling. The place of design in the conflict appears set. Given the speed at which images can circulate, the future looks bright for talented and politically motivated designers that want to influence the debate through imagery. For Monocle, in Jerusalem, I'm Joseph Dana.
Thank you very much for that, Joseph. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll be hearing the highlights from the ISH Bathroom Trade Fair in Frankfurt and the second India Design Forum in Mumbai. But before that, we're sticking with graphic design, albeit in a slightly lighter context. German illustrator, author and animator Christoph Niemann has long captured the hearts of the young and the young at heart. His whimsical narrative illustrations have appeared in the New York Times magazine for years in a column called Abstract Sunday, while his children's books include I, Lego, New York and That's How. Niemann just entered new territory, though, with Petting Zoo, a new iPad and iPhone app featuring 21 hand-drawn animals that children and grown-ups can manipulate into all sorts of positions and situations with touchscreen swipes and taps. Berlin correspondent Kimberly Bradley visited Niemann in his Berlin studio to have a swipe herself and to find out what's behind the artist's first interactive picture book.
There's 21 animals, from like the more obvious rabbit, dog, and so forth, to, you know, of course, elephants. There's an ostrich. There's a little cat chasing a butterfly. One of my favorites might be an octopus with rather complicated arm movements. And so there's a whole range of animals. And some of the things that the animals do is they just jump. And then sometimes I just try to do more surprising things. Like the animal, there's a giraffe, and when you touch the body of the giraffe, he's just like jumping up and down. But when you figure out that you can tap the head, the giraffe spins around and actually licks the screen of the iPad.
Was this developed as a children's app or as an adult app, or both?
Actually, in an ideal world, both. I'm a huge fan of the Pixar movies. And one of the things that I love about the Pixar movies is that I almost feel there's kind of two tracks running at the same time. There's the story that the kids get, but at the same time, there's all these references that are really more for grown-ups. I don't have any kind of hidden kind of messages in the app, but there was something about the game with the drawing that I hope would appeal to grown-ups as much as it does for kids. I just love the idea of doing something with animals. It was just like the most natural thing that would come to me. But it wasn't necessarily really just conceived as a kid's thing per se.
You've got fantastic music playing through the app. Can you tell me a little bit about where that music comes from?
I met this really fantastic music designer from Cape Town in South Africa, Marcus Wurmström. And he's a great musician, but he also has a lot of experience with composing music for movies and for things like this. What was interesting, as we developed the app, we realized that playing with these animals is a little bit like playing an instrument, and that people started, you know, swiping left, right, up, down, almost in a rhythmical way, and that the sounds actually have to behave like an instrument. So we started designing them more in a way that they work when you play them continuously. There's one thing where you have a big crocodile's head, and when you swipe over the teeth, they start moving and bending one way or another. And it's really like a harp. You can just swipe over all the teeth, and then you get this like chord, like this arpeggio chord of sounds happening. And so that was something that was interesting because we hadn't planned it that way, that the sound design ended up almost like building the animals as instruments.
So this was really a lot more collaborative than some of the other projects you've worked on, perhaps.
Absolutely. I mean, there was my work, like the thing that I had envisioned, which is all about the drawings and kind of like the visual metaphors and all that. But then the whole music aspect came to it. But the other aspect also was where our developer, John Wang, out of New York, was absolutely essential. He has a lot of experience from like the whole gaming world. And there's something about how to predict what a user will do. Because you can build in the most fantastic things. You can say, oh, if you do a three-finger swipe on the upper right-hand corner, it will do that. But how should the user know that you can do that? And if the user gets stuck, it's frustrating. Within 10 seconds, then everybody stops playing. If it's too predictable, then it's boring. So finding a line that you always know you're doing it right, and to have such a natural way of guiding the viewer in a way where there's always like things to find out, is incredibly hard. And it goes so much way beyond the drawing or the visual joke. It really has a lot to do with like the design of the app in terms of like showing that the app reacts to what you're doing, but also showing how it reacts.
You told me in another conversation that there was one other aspect that surprised you that was pointed out kind of at the end. Could you talk about that a little bit?
the idea was to have all these animals, you touch them, you have fun with it. And eventually I realized in a conversation with John that they just felt too separate and that we needed to turn this whole thing into a story or kind of connect them all. So a few weeks before we actually had to develop the thing, I realized I had to draw transitions from one animal to another. So it moves naturally from scene to scene, which creatively was like rather obvious once we had talked about it. And the problem was it was such an insane amount of kind of work that I essentially had to draw a 3-minute animation in 2 weeks. Everybody who has ever animated knows that 3 minutes is a long time when you go frame by frame.
Can you describe what some of the transitions are?
Well, some of them are like more like morphings, like the rabbit at the beginning turns into a doghouse out of which the dog runs. Other things are like the crocodile teeth turn into these kind of like four running legs that run through a landscape of palm trees and pyramids. The idea is always to always have the viewer guessing. It should never feel predictable. You should always kind of be surprised at what's happening.
With the final product, what do you have the most fun with?
I unfortunately know the whole thing so inside out that it's more still being amazed that it actually works. My greatest joy now is just seeing other people play it. And the greatest joy is I've seen some YouTube videos that people have sent me of their kids playing it. And that is actually really pretty fantastic.
A lot of Americans know your work, and Germans, I think, too. But for the bigger world audience, how would you describe your illustration style?
I studied graphic design. I didn't study illustration. And the whole idea as a designer is you come up with an idea, and then you come up with a certain way to make the idea come to life. You use one typeface or another. You use a photograph or a drawing. And I try to do the same thing within the illustration world that I live in. So I come up with a concept, and then I think, am I going to use a pencil drawing or an oil painting or a collage? So I try not to be guided by the style, but really by the concept, and then try to keep my vanity in check. You know, I'm an illustrator, so of course I like to draw, but I try not to kind of display my drawing skills, but really just use my drawing skills to make the idea work.
That was German illustrator and animator Christoph Niemann in his Berlin studio with our correspondent Kimberly Bradley there. You're listening to Section D. Coming up, we'll be donning our comfy shoes and stamping the trade halls of Frankfurt at ISH to discover what the future of the bathroom might look like.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Hugo MacDonald. Last week, the great and good of the bathroom and sanitation industries descended on Frankfurt for the biennial trade fair ISH. It's the largest fair of its kind, and despite chaos at Frankfurt Airport thanks to a heap of snow, exhibitors, developers, buyers and architects from around the world made it to the Messe on time. Our own associate editor, Nelly Gochiva, was in attendance too. She flushed out the biggest stories from the fair, and here's what she found.
Happening once every 2 years in Frankfurt, ISH is the world's leading trade fair for bathroom design, sanitation solutions, and renewable energies. Over 2,000 exhibitors from around the world have attended the five-day fair in Messe Exhibition Center. We catch up with Senior Vice President of Messe, Iris Jeglica, on the highlights of this year's edition.
So ISH is a world-leading show for bathroom sanitary products and heating technology and air conditioning technology. It's about warmth, water and cooling. We have a lot of companies who offer products and technologies in terms of energy efficiency, to use really energy in the most efficient way, or to monitor energy and to organize the future way of using energy in houses, either in residential houses or big professional houses like industry or office buildings, hotels, for example.
And in terms of visitors, because this is industry-only fair, mm-hmm. it's available and open only to the industry members, have you noticed any changes? Where is the biggest interest coming from, country-wise?
the biggest interest is coming from, after Germany, from Italy. Among the top 10 visiting countries are mostly European countries, but China and Asia are coming up, and North America as well.
And in terms of products and innovations, what is the latest? Have you noticed any tendencies?
The tendencies are definitely the energy efficiency or the protection of resources in terms of water, of energy, whatever kind of energy it might be. So it's more efficiency, more smart, more intelligent products. In terms of sanitary products, we do see this edition more colors. That's really surprising. You didn't see it during the last 2-3 editions, and now blue is coming back, black, red, really strong and living colors. And one big trend, especially in the bathroom sector, is our products and bathrooms who fit for generations. So that fit for a family with little children as well as elderly people, so they can live as long as possible in their private homes. So there are a lot of new technologies, the lifting of wash basins, for example, or the easy access into the shower and something like that.
And to find out more about the latest trends in bathroom design, we stop by Grohe. Based in Düsseldorf, the company is Europe's largest manufacturer of sanitary fittings and shower systems. We check in with Paul Flowers, Senior Vice President of Design, about the company's latest products.
This year we're launching a number of new products. Some of the highlights will be F-Digital Deluxe, a complete modular digital range including showers, an ambient controller, which controls lighting, sound and steam. So sound, audio therapy, chromotherapy of the lighting, and then of course with the steam aquatherapy. So a real spa concept. A new collection called Grandera, which is what we call an elegant classic collection in a number of different finishes. And several showers, for example, Power and Soul in six colors, spa colors, we call them the Naturals collection. And they have a very innovative coma spray based off the Aboriginal head massage, that was the inspiration. We're looking at how water can move in and out to massage the scalp to stimulate blood flow. And of course, when you stimulate blood flow, you release endorphins, so you obviously feel good. So we're looking at how water can create a physiological change, if you like. Products like this, of course, we have a blue mono product that we've launched, and that's looking at basically filtering, chilling and providing two types of sparkling water, medium and full sparkling, fully carbonated. And that product, of course, is trying to remove the need for people drinking bottled water all the time, which is horrendous for the environment. Just a one plastic bottle, polyethylene terephthalate, takes 7 liters of water to make the plastic bottle that then you put 1 liter of water in and ship that all over the world. So we want to give consumers a viable alternative to drinking bottled water.
From Grohe, we move on to Spain-based sanitary giant Roca to hear more on energy savings and water efficiency. We chat with Roca's design and innovation director, Joseph Cognos. First, we ask him about Roca's key new products.
We have several novelties, but mainly the two big novelties are one is called Intang, that really we presented 2 years ago as a concept. And now we are presenting the final product and we are starting sales of this product. The Intang is a toilet that the characteristic that is the water is inside the bowl. So the water not is in one tank that is placed inside the bowl or over the toilet. Really the water is inside the toilet. And also is a dual flush toilet, that means trying to save water as a maximum. And the other product is we call InWash. That really is a shower toilet that is integrated. Shower toilet means like a Japanese toilet that uses water for cleaning your body. But for us, it's quite relevant to integrate the ceramic with the technology. So in some ways, we could say that it's a high technology. Also, saving energy is nowadays relevant for everybody, also for high top products. People are aware about how much water is using the products. But perhaps the more relevant that we are trying to do is to communicate how much water uses each product. because until now nobody was taking care about if one faucet is using 6 liters or 20 liters. So until now, all the faucets were similar from the point of view of performance. Nobody takes care about the performance, only style or fashion or color. And nowadays we are trying to communicate that. It's quite simple, but it's not easy to have the same communication for all the manufacturers. So unfortunately, in Europe, there are a lot of countries with a lot of regulations, and each country is trying to build specific regulations about water saving and energy saving. And for a global company as Arroca, it's quite difficult to follow these trends for each country. So at the end, we are trying to build our own policy about water safe.
Which countries are more open towards these new water saving and energy saving products?
I think we have two main areas that are focusing this big change. One is States, United States in California. He also started with the electrical car in the 17th. So they now are pushing quite strong in water and energy saving. And the other area is, for instance, Singapore or Arabia Saudi, these kinds of countries that really they are quite pushing the industry in saving water as much as possible. I think we have two contradictions. One is trying to have the minimum water, but in the other side we want wellness experience or using bath with 300 liters or having very nice bathrooms with a lot of water that it's needed. No? So we are trying to explain that one thing is water saving, another thing is comfort. How to combine both things, no?
And what is the solution? How do we combine these two?
The solution is reusing the water. So a lot of water that is used in the shower, for instance, could later be used in the toilet. Or the water that is used in the bath also could be used in the toilet.
For Monocle, with a splash, I'm Nelly Gocheva.
Thank you very much indeed, Nelly. And we're staying on the trade fair carousel, but heading to India next. The past week has seen design shows all over Mumbai in conjunction with the second annual India Design Forum, which was held at the weekend. Growing disposable incomes mean Indians are starting to spend some serious rupees on design. Still, though, design is a fairly new concept to India, and Indian design is barely making waves at home, let alone internationally. But industry players say there's a lot of potential. To find out just how progressive design in India is, and to get an idea of just how responsive homegrown design is to India's unique needs, Monocle's New Delhi correspondent Aarti Betigeri pounded the streets of Mumbai to bring us this report.
Advertisement of art? I don't know about it.
Indian cultural gatherings have a reputation for attracting huge numbers. Bishnosh, the India Design Forum, which is a far more niche affair, with mostly design insiders and students in attendance. The two-day programme brings together international designers working in disciplines as varied as food styling, product design and fashion, as well as celebrated local artists such as Subodh Gupta. With much of the local design industry still in its infancy, there are lots of up-and-comers but few established players beyond architecture.
The idea of design is relatively new in India. It's essentially come to us through an education system that is perhaps 50 years old. What's happening now, I think, is as our levels of consumption are growing and the economic value attached or created by design processes are being appreciated and the values are accruing, our own kind of understanding of what values Indian design can bring to design processes is kind of growing.
Madhav Raman is a trained architect now working across a number of design disciplines, including urban and installation art.
In India, there's a very strong movement for design to start thinking about consumption. Purely from the field that I specialize in, which is architecture, there are questions of sustainability, but I think currently what I'm beginning to realize is that perception of sustainability has to do with the balance between consuming and wasting. I think going forward, those are the questions that are going to really invigorate design conversations or discourses coming out of India.
India is a country with some rather specific issues that designers need to consider. There are extreme temperatures, rapid urbanization, and strong heritage values. So for any emerging designer to succeed, it's vital they work with these constraints in mind.
Gurjeet Matharu, who is based out of Ahmedabad, he's an architect, a young architect, he's about 45. He addresses things like the climate and materiality with a very unique kind of sense of a structured modernist approach, but again very Indian in its sensibility. So the aesthetic is perhaps not obviously Indian, but a lot of the underlying themes in his work about how he treats outdoor spaces or indoor spaces or where they come together are uniquely Indian. There's this wonderful design that he's just done, is this door that works like a curtain. And that brings to mind a whole lot of other questions. It brings to mind what our notions of barriers are and whether they actually need to be opaque, and you know, or does there need to be a reflexiveness in how we go between indoors and outdoors? Because architecturally speaking, that is the fundamental, the spine on which sustainability rests, is what do we consider indoors and what do we consider outdoors, and whether our relationship with our climate is a friendly one or whether it is confrontational, you know, whether we want to become introverted and then prevent the climate from affecting structures that we create, or allow our structures to breathe and interact and, you know, move along those lines.
Charavi Agarwal is the founder of a studio specializing in animation and digital design, everything from installations to games. She says that while things are starting to change, India's design industry has been hindered by a resistance to embrace the changing times.
This is an age of technology. People need to adopt, you know, we have painters, we have talent all across, but nobody is educating themselves in new mediums. So that's what's restricting us, primarily. And whosoever is coming out of design schools, they either, you know, they migrate to different countries for services, or they try to get involved into stable jobs. Because stability is one factor that every family wants. So when it comes to stepping out and creating your own hub or setting up your own company or something of that sort, it's very niche. We are growing, but it's going to take a good amount of time. Considering that we are a third world country and, you know, we have the maximum number of population, there is growth, but the growth takes its time. The movement requires time. So it is going, but what I'm saying is for a fruit to mature, it will probably take another 5-6 years down the line so that you actually see that peak, that momentum where you see all the designers in India doing wonderful and unique stuff.
What Indian designers do have in their favour is an extraordinarily rich legacy of arts and crafts. One man who knows this all too well is design consultancy owner Dipendra Bawani, who is drawing on almost 1,000 years of artistic heritage.
So basically, I'm the 39th generation of Rajput miniature artists from the kingdom of Rewa, which is in central India. My forefathers have always been the miniature artists of the court. My family is traced back to 1119 AD. We have a family tree back at home, which kind of illustrates that the Bawani family is fairly renowned in the art circles. I'm a designer, though. I am one of the only few, in my generation, the only few people who actually branched out of art and started doing design, which is more really applied art. India's always been a culture that has valued attention to detail and the implications that it has on society and life as such. And I think that continues today as well. Okay, we may have lost some of our aesthetic sense and our attention to detail, but I think most of the designers who are doing some great stuff, they always are inspired by the attention to detail that our forefathers had put in. And I think that's what has made us who we are. And in fact, that's why we're such a peaceful society. I think it was always a celebratory and a festive idea that India's always thrived on. You know, even our daily dresses are extremely festive and vibrant and colorful, you know, and I think that's the true essence of India.
Now that the design community is mobilizing, it likely won't be long until that very essence is harnessed in creating a distinctive design identity for India. For Monocle at the India Design Forum in Mumbai, I'm Aarti Beshagiri.
Thank you, Arti. If you've just joined us, you're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. Still to come, we'll be dropping into the Porto studio of Portuguese graphic designers R2. Next up, we're off to Jakarta to talk toys.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D, where we're now in Jakarta. Former theme park designer Chipta Croft-Cusworth has turned his fascination with play into the art of making toys. Something of a pioneer on the Jakarta toy and comic scene, known best for his Good Guys Never Win label, Chipta is renowned for his collectible Tim Burton-esque creations that appeal as much to children as to adults. Raised in the bustling Asian metropolis of Jakarta, Croft-Cusworth has admired villains and baddies since his school days. These days, though, his playground is his workshop, his own store, and also his toy museum. Kate Lamb met the 34-year-old designer in his multiple conceptual playgrounds, including Jakarta's annual toy fair, to get an insight into what it's like to live in Never Never Land.
Jakarta's annual toy fair is a jungle. A jungle where stormtroopers, zombies, vampires and Harajuku dolls come out to play. There are lightsaber battles, life-size Lego constructions and hundreds of stalls selling every action hero imaginable. And it's mostly all grown-ups. Grown-ups like local toy importer Hendro, who sells uniquely programmed robots.
It's maybe around one week. Let's program this one. Full Gangnam style, yeah. 1 week for imitating the Gangnam style, yes. Yeah, it's quite popular over here in Indonesia.
There's also 24-year-old Irwan, who saved up several months for this.
The famous Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Wow.
Yeah, it's really cool, right?
But Star Wars and Arnie are not for everyone. One corner of the convention hall has been turned into a proper playground for kids.
Put it in that one, that way. That's right.
Meet toy designer Chipta Croft-Cusworth.
Over here, we've got Hot Shots. It's kind of a blaster.
He's walking me through his own version of a PlayStation. In each corner, kids seem completely absorbed, lost, playing in their own worlds.
The whole area is about playtime, rather than... If you look outside at the rest of the toy fair, it's all about the collectors and it's a different market.
There is a toy railway set and a figure eight Hot Wheels car track, a blaster station, magnetized yo-yos, and even one corner where kids can design their own action figures. Out of the thousands of drawings, the best designs will actually be selected and produced.
I think getting the kids to do it themselves and then taking the best ideas, like whether there's robot arms or whether it's, you know, mutant heads, or I think it's all good. Basically, I think the best way is to get the kids to do it themselves.
Recently headhunted by the Asia-based toy company Emco, Chipta has been closely observing the phenomenon of play. It seems a somewhat fated role for the former theme park designer. Before he was the brand manager of the country's biggest toy company, the 34-year-old half-Brit made a name for himself with his niche brand, Good Guys Never Win. It's famous on the toy scene here for its steampunk, Frankenstein-esque creations, what he describes as cute war machines. It started off with a childhood fascination with baddies. Growing up in Indonesia, many of the toys Chipta wanted weren't available, so he simply started casting them out of resin himself.
Well, I first started off doing stormtroopers. I wanted to be the kid with the most stormtroopers ever since I was, you know, ever since I started playing with stormtroopers. So I just did thousands and thousands of these stormtroopers, and then it was like, okay, what else can I do?
The obsession snowballed from there. His original resin-inspired dolls are quickly catching on with university students. And while customizing toys is very big here, Chipta says he is one of the only Indonesian designers with his own toy company.
The Dolores here.
This is the one of the first big Good Guys Never Win creations.
Dolores, or Dolls of Resin, became a hit in 2005. The baby-faced robot has spaceship thighs and tanks for feet. Today, Dolores and her most recent permutations live at Kampung Mainan, or Toy Village, a section of an inner-city Jakarta mall devoted to toys. It's here where Chipta has his workshop and store that you get an insight into his fascination with the quirky and the macabre. It's full of fitting paraphernalia.
Well, this is a cheetah skull. It's a resin cast cheetah skull. And this was one of the heads of one of the DeLoreans. This is a chimpanzee skull, and this is a fox skull.
The skull collection, he says, was inherited from his father.
I have this vast skull collection I inherited from my dad. My dad used to work for the London Museum, and his job was stripping the animals of, I guess, the flesh and reconstructing them to be in the museums. And a lot of the skeletons were incomplete, or, you know, broken bones meant that they couldn't be used. So he has like all these bones. He had all these bones around the house and lots of skulls. And ever since I was a little kid, very young, I was always playing with them. It was like one of the cool things that I had. And as well, because I was always into the baddies, like they just fit into like anything I was building.
The shop counter is lined with neat rows of hand-painted toy soldiers, also a throwback to his dad.
First one is villains in the city, or city of villains. And then the next one is villains in fantasy.
And of course, there is the obligatory gun in his treasure chest.
This is the Longstrike CS6, and it's my weapon of choice. If zombies ever took over and they were allergic to Nerf.
Chipta is also the creative genius behind Mall Wars, something akin to the art of running amok in mega malls with concealed plastic weapons, and is the creator of a toy museum with three elaborate diorama installations.
First one is villains in the city, or city of villains, and then the next one is villains in fantasy.
From killer fembots to cute plastic trains, Chipta says the underlying purpose is the same, finding or prolonging that sense of childlike wonder.
Toys are vessels for your subconscious, like you become the toy. You don't see your hand holding a rocket flying through a kitchen. You see the rocket in space, and you know that the captain of the rocket is you, and you know that you've got this team to back you up, and when you land where you're going to land, like, you know that there's an adventure waiting.
As a designer, he says, you can't make kids see what you want them to see. You have to see what they see. Chipta says it was a conscious decision to never let go of that feeling. Even though he admits the new gig is a very grown-up step in his evolution as a designer.
This is like millions of dollars, and a lot of people really relying on me to create a cool trend, or to find what's cool, you know, and exploit the fact that I can read what's cool. You know, I feel like I've been following toys for so long now, as somebody who collects toys, as somebody who plays with toys and understands what works and what doesn't. Like, now is my chance to really shine, to really show that it's not all in vain, you know. My mother would, like, I remember when I went to university, my mom and dad were like, you're taking one knapsack of clothes and you've got two cases of toys. And they were like, why are you doing that? What's They didn't say what's wrong with you, but I know that's what they were thinking. Now, I mean, they understand now.
For every misunderstood child that wants to be king of the castle. For Monocle in Jakarta, this is Kate Lamb.
Thank you for that, Kate. And we round off our hour this week back in Portugal with a dip into the studio of a graphic design team whose work we're loving at the moment. Lisa Ramalho and Artur Rebelo's are two studio covers projects which include identity work, posters, books and exhibition designs for a wide range of cultural clients. We dispatched Saima Tariq to meet the award-winning duo in their Porto studio to discuss the current state of their graphic art.
in a quiet residential street off Porto's Boa Vista Avenue. Liza Ramalho and Arto Rubello have just moved into their new studio with their dog, Safi. The pair form one of Europe's most intriguing design studios today. Their work traversing graphic creation, installations, typography, and creative communication from a humble two-story base in Portugal's northern second city. Members of the Alliance Graphique Internationale and recipients of numerous awards, including gold at both Red Dot and at the European Design Awards, R2's social approach and perfected execution has made them the go-to studio not only for editorial and print work, but also now for Portugal's museums, architects and artists.
Because we are starting working in spaces, our work attracts new kind of clients. Yeah, it's weird, but we are graphic designers. We start from paper, but we can cross all media. We did videos, web, and now since 2006 we are starting working on three-dimensional projects. In the beginning we start by small things in scale, and now we are going even bigger. In materials like from paper to concrete or rocks.
The keen playfulness of previous graphic design work for institutions such as the Sorel's Museum or the Zagreb Museum of Arts and Craft has naturally evolved into a humanistic binding of form and content for their current, sometimes larger scale work, be it a Lisbon chapel covered in a typographic light box facade, or a series of alphabet pieces evoking David Poulard's font Ordinaire, based on a found object in the interior landscape of Portugal.
Even sometimes our language is not so humanistic. The final goal is to touch people and to communicate with people, so we are kind of humanistic.
I agree with this, this way of seeing our work. I think we have a humanistic approach, formally also.
Yeah,
in the sense of the humanistic approach, yeah. Sorry. Yeah,
but we like very much the modernism and the neutral typography, international style, really, really clean. But at the same time, we want to put something that's
is more emotional.
So
it. That's I think, yeah.
Yeah, we are doing a house for a couple. He asked us to do an intervention in house. So we said that we are not architects, we are graphic designers. No, but I saw your work and I want you to do these projects. So we came with an idea. Everything in walls and doors, they can move. It's like they can communicate with people inside. They can kidding. They can joke. They can play with typography. It's a grid. It's based on a grid system. It's like modular from Corbusier, but it's the inspiration comes from the typography. Yeah. How would you say? We design a typeface for each people, father, mother and daughter, and they can communicate between them.
So instead of having already fixed sentence, they can change their ideas, they can change humor, they can left message to people that are coming at their homes. If they have a party, they want to change it, they can change the decoration, but they will change the message also with this project.
Emotion is as important as function for R2, and they can instill that dual category with enormous effect. The signage work for Lisbon's Barado Museum is a case in point.
We have this, for example, the pictograms from the walls, from the toilets. They wanted us to sign them, of course, along with all the signage system. But then when we arrived with the proposal, they thought, well, this looks a little bit like art. So maybe instead of putting them outside, we could put your work inside the doors and put something more
regular
signage. And we were like very upset because, I mean, we were asked in the brief to do something different, something more playful, something that would involve people, that would make them think. Besides, of course, first of all, it has to accomplish the first function, that is to tell people that is the bathroom. But that was done. So we had some little fights. But at the end, they thought, no, I think that really looks good. And it's funny because some years after that, we just received a call from a researcher. He wanted to put one of them for the disabled in the cover of a book, and he asked us permission to do. So I think it's funny also because this wall, this huge wall at the entrance, to have this idea of telling people what they can do at the museum instead of what they cannot do. Girlfriend and boyfriend can kiss, they can, it was positive approach, everything you can do. And we had some balloons with this, and every person that would enter the museum, or a lot of people, would take pictures in front of this wall and interact with it. So, I mean, this was, of course, not neutral. It's a museum of contemporary art. Of course, the signage was not, but it was not on the parts where you have the art, because there we were very quiet, having the same system. But there are places where you can play, where you can have provide a different moment to people. And I think that's what a museum also should do.
Flicking through Artie's portfolio, which is diverse and sometimes bewilderingly various, one overarching trait prevails: the revelation of humanity through simply great design. For Monocle in Porto, I'm Simon Tarek.
And that brings us to the end of this week's episode of Section D. Next week, we'll be hearing the highlights of this year's London Design Awards. We'll be discussing American and Dutch modernist graphic design with Richard Spencer Powell. And we'll be joined by design critic Alice Rawsthorne to discuss her new book, Hello World. So be sure to tune in then. This show was produced by Alid John and Holly Fisher. If you'd like to get in touch with Alid to feature on Section D, or to bend his ear on some burning topic you feel we should be covering, you can contact him on awj@monocle.com. In the meantime, I'm going to leave you with a track inspired by Chipta's tales of boyish, toyish wonder. Here's LaRue with I'm Not Your Boy. I've been Hugo MacDonald. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. I'm not your toy.